Hi, my name is Marie, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been called a lot of things, but a fruitcake never. First off, I want to thank Dirk for giving the call to myself and to my husband for this, to come up here and speak. It's always an honor to come and share your story. You know, and I really like Mont Eagle. I was brought up here by my sponsee, Marianne. And she brought me here, and I fell in love with it. Absolutely fell in love with Mont Eagle. And I couldn't figure out how in the world I was going to get Dave up here. Thank you, Dirk. Thank you. So anyway, my sobriety date is December 11th, 1994. My home group is Germantown Noon in Germantown, Tennessee. And we meet on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at noon. And as good alcoholics at Germantown Noon, we also meet at 8 o'clock and at 9:30 on Saturday morning. If you're ever in Germantown, you'll see me sit in my chair somewhere Monday, Wednesday, and Friday as a rule. I do have a sponsor. Her name is Donna, and she has a sponsor, and her name is Carrie. And the trick of that is, what I'm saying that for, is having a sponsor is very different than being sponsored. And I have the great privilege of being sponsored today, and it is a great privilege for a woman to take time out of her life to show me this way of life. And that's what she did. She showed me. She didn't say much. Well, that's a lie. She did. She had a way of telling me things. But I'm just really grateful for her in my life. You know, I'm nervous. I'm always nervous, can't eat, my stomach hurts, and then I sit next to Kelly and I laugh like crazy. You know, and it's and Walt says, you know, that laughter is the medicine of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it truly is. You've brought laughter to my life today. I didn't have it before. I was raised in a family with six kids, and I was number five. And I was raised in a family that was extremely Catholic. And I was raised where the bells were ringing, we were kneeling, and the incense was going, and mass on a daily basis. This is my mother and father raised us that way. My dad is a World War II vet, very proud too. He was a prisoner of war over there in Achmen, Germany, and when he came home, he was a really different man. And my mother really. My mother is a quiet woman. She comes from what they would call blue blood out of New York City. And so when she came, and my mom and dad were very different people. And I was the kind of kid, in my household, there was a lot of yelling and screaming, and screaming and yelling, and yelling and screaming, and this girl dove underneath the table. I had my Barbie dolls underneath there. I was all set to play because I knew that the yelling and the screaming would be coming. You know, but when I first went into recovery, which is really funny, is my family didn't look like that at all. I was from the Rockwell family. Because I was raised in a family, and we were talking about this earlier, and it jarred some memories for me that you didn't talk about anything outside that door, what was happening inside. And so I came from a family where there were secrets. We had the most manicured lawn. My father had the most manicured, wherever we lived, it was manicured. And my mother really had the house clean to the best of ability she could with six kids. But there was always, you just didn't talk about what happened inside of the house. And so I was raised that way as well. You know, my mother was a mother where she didn't have to say much for me to move. My mother had a look. And we used to go to Mass on Sunday. My mother used to sit and have all six kids in front. Mom and Dad used to sit behind. You move one muscle when you were not supposed to move that muscle. That flick behind that ear was there. And my poor sister Jane, God bless her soul, she got smacked every Sunday. You know, and I was raised, we moved a lot. My father was, I was a corporate orphan. It's the only way I could say my father moved us around. I don't know how. I went to 11 elementary schools. And by the time I hit high school, my mother had it. That was it. We weren't moving again. And we did, and we stayed into Florida. It was Clearwater, Florida that I was raised. You know, and I was the kind of kid that, and I was the kind of teenager that, you know, I really wanted you to look at me. I really wanted you to look at me, but don't look at me. Don't let me know that you're looking at me. Look at me, but don't look at me. You know, and I don't know how to describe it except that I walked around a whole life going, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me. What? Why are you looking at me? What are you thinking? You know, and I always thought people were talking about me, laughing at me, whatever they were doing. I just thought they were laughing at me all the time. I promise you I wouldn't go to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers game because I thought for sure they were huddled in the middle of the 50-yard line laughing at moi. You know, don't you know how important I am? You know, and I could think for you. I could tell you exactly what you were thinking just by the look you have on your face, because you're giving me one of those looks, and my husband has that look, and I know exactly what he's thinking. And you know what? He has nothing up there, and I'm thinking for sure he's thinking about me. I honestly believe that. And as a teenager, I was one of those girls that, you know, I was a homecoming queen. I was a cheerleader, and you know, and I was the kind of kid that if you told me to go left, I would go right. And I honestly thought I was going left. And when I was doing the cheering and everything, and if there was a joke at my school, there's Marie over in the corner doing her own cheer because they're all doing something else because my brain could not catch up with what was going on. I was really slow that way. In fact, you know, if you have dyslexia of the brain, maybe that's what I had, you know, because I really didn't understand. You tell me left, I'd go right. You tell me to go up, I'd go down. You tell me to look, don't look. Whatever, it was always the opposite of what you wanted me to do. I was a really confused girl. You know, and then in high school, and my mom and dad at that time didn't come and watch any of their children in any of their sports at that time. By the fifth one, they were tired. You know, and so they didn't come and watch me on any of my sports events, any of my cheerleading or anything. That was a memory that came to me in the last 5 years. You know, as I keep sobering up and I keep on this path, the memory bubbles come back. And I thank God for that, because if I had all this memory that I have today after 22 years, I don't know if 22 days sobriety, I know what I know now, I'm not real sure I would have stuck around. But God knew what I needed, and He unveils when it's time for me, all the time. You know, and in high school, you know, in my family, when you wanted to have a report, when you brought home your report card, and it was a time that they were written report cards. And when they written report cards, you'd have your grades on the front, and your grades in the front, which were written by the sisters or the nuns that were there, and on the back was your conduct. My father didn't care if you failed. He turned that card over, and you better be behaving yourself. No matter what. And I had sisters and brothers that they had a reputation, and I was a good kid. I was a good kid. Was I smartest in the class? No, but I wasn't really the dumbest either. I mean, I was able to get away with a lot of stuff by just blinking my eyes, and I knew that, and I used it too, you know. And so, you know, as in high school, we would come home and my dad would line us up, and if any of us were out of line, we got in trouble. Because don't you ever bring shame down on the Peterson High household, ever. And do not ever use that name unless it's of good and no secrets in this household. That's what I was raised with. You know, and in high school, and I was senior in high school, I met this boy, and I fell in love, and I got pregnant. I mean, you know, I went to prom, and I think more girls get pregnant on prom than any other time, but in prom, I became pregnant, and, you know, he got this scholarship to Florida State University to play baseball, and he had this thing, he's going to go play baseball, and he was going somewhere. See, my father said to me, since the time I was 14 years old, Marie, you don't need to go to college, just marry yourself an ambitious man. He'll take care of you. And I think he was saying that because by the time he got to us, he didn't have enough money for us to go to college. So I did exactly what my father told me to do. So I was pregnant. I didn't want to get married. And I wasn't going to ruin this man's life who was going to go to baseball. And I wasn't about to bring this baby home into the home that I was raised in. You know, there wasn't violence in the way of physical violence, but there was always something in my house that wasn't right. Just wasn't right. And I innately knew that I didn't want to keep this baby. And I was really, you know, for me, I had a really good experience with the priests and the nuns growing up. I have tears in my eyes when I think about those women and men in my life. You know, and one of them said, well, I do know of an unwed mother's home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And this is pre-Roe versus Wade. So I ran away to an unwed mother's home. My mom wasn't really happy. I brought shame down on the house. My mother didn't, she was so ashamed of me that I got pregnant. But my father, of all people, put his arms around me and said, Marie, I love you. And we'll get through this because we're Petersons. That blew my mind, absolutely blew my mind that my father would say anything like that. So I run away to an unwed mother's home. But let me digress. My first drink was when I was 16 years old. And that was down at Boot Ranch Farm down in Oldsmar, Florida. And when I had that first drink, and it was Peach Farm, Boone's wine, and I drank that thing, and you know, but I drank more, and I realized that I could jump off that bridge just a little bit better. And I knew the boys started to look really good because I was pretty shy. I was really not confident of who I was. I was always tripping over my own feet and going in the wrong direction. You know, and so when I drank, it gave me this sense of fun. And I was so sick, but I couldn't wait to go back out and have some more drinks. I just couldn't wait. Well, I get pregnant, and I go to the unwed mother's home, and I give the baby up for adoption. And this man that was the father to the baby went off to Florida State University. Then I came home, and I had nowhere else to go, and I came home back to Clearwater, Florida to live with my mom. I was there for 12 days before I moved out, and I started working in the restaurant business, and I started in a pizza place, and I started drinking, and the next thing I know, I become a bartender. I had so much fun tending bar, folks. Oh, my God. I had more fun. I ended up getting married at the age of 19. I married this man. 2 years later, after I gave the baby up for the adoption, and he is the father of that baby. It was back in the day when you signed those papers, all bets are off, there's no way you can find it. It was closed, that was it. And so Dave and I got married in 1976. And in that time, we moved to Boston because David, his career in baseball wasn't going where exactly he wanted to go, so we went to Boston. And I was pregnant. Hello, pregnant again, and we had Paul, and once we had Paul, I got back into the bar business, and I went back waitressing and tending bar, and you know, when you started drinking, it was more fun, you know, you'd have shooter time, you'd call the girls up, and you'd have a drink, lay it out, and you'd shoot, and you'd go, and it was just natural, it's what you did, and it wasn't, I didn't have a real hard time with it at first, but then what happened was, I started coming home later and later. But I had to get home at a certain time in Boston because David was working. I worked from 5 to 12, and Dave was a security man from like 12:30 to 7, and then he went to school all day. Then I went to bar because we didn't want anybody watching our kids but us. Crazy, but that's what we did. Well, after he graduated from college, we moved back to Florida and got a job again as a bartender. And I absolutely loved it. And I drank, and what would happen is, and in the meantime, we had another daughter, and the drinking it came to the point where I wasn't drinking for fun anymore. I was getting to the point when I drank, I was looking forward to going to the drink. And when I drank, I didn't drink at home. I wasn't a cookie burner. I didn't stay at home and burn the cookies, and I didn't drink at home. What I would do was this is only looking backwards, I had no idea I was doing it then, but I would try to piss Dave off as much as I could so I can get out that door and go have a drink. And the drinking came to the point where I would sit at a bar, and I'd sit at that bar, and I'd go, I'm only going to have two. And I would sit at the bar, they would serve me the drink, and I would count those stir sticks. And I'd do it, and I'd drink it, and then I would have another one, And I'd see the stirred sticks down on the counter because I said I'm only going to have two. That's all I said I was going to do. And I'd take it and I'd swipe them off the bar and I'd say, come on. And then by the time it's running late, I'd go, he's mad anyway. What the hell? I'll just stay on out. He's mad at me anyway. And I would drink. It got to a point where I was drinking and I would be home an hour late and then maybe 5 days a week, and then it was 7 days a week, and some days I would just be gone. And it got to the point in my drinking where I looked at it like the marriage, well, I can't stand this guy. You know, if you're married to him, you don't be married to him. Are you kidding me? He doesn't know how to drink. He doesn't know how to have fun. I like to have fun. He doesn't like to have fun. And, you know, these kids. And what happened was, and I didn't realize it was alcohol, but I walked out on my kids and my husband. Just walked out. One day I came home and I said, Dave, I had enough. I'm out of here. And I walked out of that house and I walked down to the beach in Clearwater, Florida, and I decided that living with another guy was a way to do it. And I lived with this other guy down in Florida, and he drank just like I did. In fact, he was drank worse than I did. And I drank and I was holding this bar, and I was the type of bartender that if you came to my bar and you asked for a virgin colada, I'd say, there's nothing virgin at this bar, nothing virgin going out. And so if you ordered a virgin colada in Clearwater, Florida at a place called G. David Howard's Comedy Club, I'm sorry, you know. You wanted coffee, you got decaf, screw ya. And that's my attitude. That was my attitude. And at the bar, if you're at the bar and you make me really mad, I kept Visine underneath the counter so that I could put it in your drink and hello, you'd be in the bathroom for days. And I didn't care about anything. And I would drink and I would party, and I had these kids at home and I didn't care, and Dave. And it went on like this. And I'm a blackout drinker. There's parts of my life that I don't remember. And I'm very grateful to the God of my understanding. Nothing really happened to me, because it really could have. And if it did, I don't know anything about it. You know, I found myself in places that women shouldn't go, being with people that women shouldn't be around. People shouldn't be around. Whew, not just women, you know. And I had this persona at night, you know, and I thought this was fun. I thought this was the way to live. And I had a husband at home and two kids. He was just a ball and chain. I didn't need him in my life. So I finally got into this, I lost my job because I was caught stealing alcohol at G. David's, and then I got another job, and I was shaking so bad, I couldn't hold the tray correctly, and, you know, a hair of the dog, that'll take care of it. And I would wake up, towards the end, I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd go, oh, I can't believe this happened again. I just can't believe this happened again. And I would turn over and pop that beer can, and I would drink it and say, it's okay. I'll think about it tomorrow. Not realizing that I had an allergy to alcohol. Not realizing that it's the first drink that set it off. No idea. None. So what happened was I couldn't keep any job, and I finally got this job at stuffing envelopes where, you know, for the value packs and the coupons. And I couldn't even keep that one because I was getting blood all over the place because I was shaking and I couldn't get it in. I had an apartment that I was late paying rent. I was late. And I had a car that I was hiding because it was going to be repossessed. I get a phone call in October of 1986 from my husband, who I don't think I'd been home for quite some time. Now, I was in blackout, people, so his story is going to be a little bit different than mine, I'm sure. But what I remember is he called me and he said, Marie, I want you to come down to the office and meet me. And my husband worked, is a businessman, had a big Italian desk, and you know, so I go down there and he's sitting behind the desk and he says, and this is what I heard. Now what he said may be different because, like I said, he's going to be a little different. And what I heard was, Marie, I don't know what your problem is. I don't know what it is, but I think it has to do with alcohol. Wise man. And he says, I want you to go. He says, I'm going to take away the kids, the house, and the dogs. And I went, oh, the dogs. Now, when I got drunk, I'd bring dogs home. Now, they could be your dogs in the backyard of your home. They'd end up in the backyard of my home because I didn't think you took care of well of them. And I had all these dogs, and David, the dogs, kids, the house, and he was really taking everything. And so I told him the only answer that I knew how when he told me that I needed to do something, I just walked out the door and went, and out the door I went. And I went back to my apartment, and on the way back to the apartment, I picked up a bottle of Chablis by Ross, Julio, whatever, those big gallon things. And I went back to my apartment. As I walked in my apartment, the television, I turned the television on, and as I turned on that television, there was this alcoholic priest being interviewed by a nun. And I went, are you kidding me? Really? And I turned the thing off. And then the next thing I do is I opened up the yellow pages. This is 1986. I opened up the yellow pages, and inside of the yellow pages, I saw Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, well, in the bar business, you hear about it. You hear more about Al-Anon in the alcoholic in the bar business than I did as an alcoholic. So, anyway, I called AA, and this woman on the phone, and she was really, really, really nice, and she said, "Honey, there's a real Southern accent." She says, "Honey, there's a meeting tonight at the corner of Bellevue and the end of the street." And I said, "No, no, thank you," and I hung the phone up. Now, when I dialed the phone, like this, right? And so the next thing I know is the phone rings as I hang up, and it's my mother-in-law on the phone, and, oh, Joanne. And Joanne says, "Marie, I don't know what the problem is with you two, but I think if you just put Jesus in the middle of your marriage, everything's going to be fine." And I went, "You," and I said things that a woman shouldn't say. And I hung that phone up on her. And as I did that, I looked at the yellow pages, and there was a treatment center, so I went into the treatment center in 1986. And as I'm in that treatment center, David threw me in there, he took off for Asia for the first time, and I was in there for 28 days, and I got to tell you what, it spun me dry. It spun me dry, whipped me out, and ripped me right into AA. And in those first 6 years of my sobriety, I did exactly what you weren't supposed to do. I did everything they told me not to do, and I did it anyway. So I went home after the treatment center, and it was around Thanksgiving time. I get home at Thanksgiving time, and David says, and I'm kind of excited because it's Thanksgiving, and I haven't been home for months. And I decided to go to get a turkey, and I got some green beans, and I bring it home, and Dave goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "We're going to have Thanksgiving dinner." And he said, "Oh, no, no. I'm going to Lynn's house." Unbeknownst to me, he had a little chickie on the other side at St. Petersburg, Florida. And he took the kids, and he went to Lynn's house. And I called the lady that you're supposed to call when you get home from treatment. And I said, "Oh, my gosh, my husband is not going to be here for Thanksgiving dinner. He's got a girlfriend." She goes, "Honey, take the keys, put it in the car." She told me exactly what to do. So I did exactly what she told me to do. And I went to one of those 24-hour alcathons that you have, and I thought I died and went to hell. I was like, "Are you kidding me?" Today it's very different, and I'm very grateful for gratitude dinners. I really am, but I wasn't then. And so anyway, I stuck around AA, and I got myself a sponsor, and she really tried. She really tried. But don't you know that I know everything? Don't know why, but I do. And I know everything, and I stuck around. And, you know, it says in our book that the spiritual life, and I'm terrible with the book. I just know it's on the right-hand side of the page up here somewhere. And it says something about the spiritual life for the low spots in our lives. If we don't grow in spiritual, we will not be able to do the low part starts in our lives. And what had happened to me is in 1988, almost 89, David came home one day and said, "Hey, Marie, how about moving? And Dave and I are back in the house together. He's living on one side, I'm living on the other, and we're playing the happy family. You know, and because Dave was in Al-Anon, David decided to go to Al-Anon. I'm here to tell you, Al-Anon, I'm so grateful for you. I am so grateful for Al-Anon. It saved our marriage. It really did. It really did. You know, and so he came home and he says, we're going to move to Hong Kong. And I just kind of said, well, where the heck is that? And he went and got a globe out. And he spun the globe and he showed me where it was at the very southern tip of China. And I went, well, can't be any worse than living in Memphis, Tennessee. And I've never been there in my life, and here I am. So I don't throw things out to the universe because they come back and bite my butt. So here I am in Memphis. So anyway, we go and we get all ready, and you know, and I had a really good home group, and I was really active in my home group. You know, I was making coffee, greeter. I did the GSR thing for a year, and you know, but I still wasn't doing all the steps, you know. You know, and the traditions were only when I felt like I could do them or whatever. I was just, you know, I was Miss AA to you out here. I think the old timers knew what was going on, but hey. You know, so anyway, we moved to Hong Kong. We moved to Hong Kong, and I go to my very first meeting there. I walk in there, and it's not like what I thought it should be. What are they doing? They're not doing it like we do it. Nobody said hello to me when I walked in the meeting. Not one woman got up out of that chair to say hello to me. I walked into a new meeting. I'm a new face. Nobody saw me. Nobody said hello. And I went, well. Now, remember, I'm leaving AA one judgment at a time before I'm even coming here to Hong Kong. Second meeting I go to, not one person got out of the chair. And then they were reading something, and they said the word controversy, and I said, what? Controversy, people. What are you talking about? It's not controversy. Then they don't have brewed coffee. Oh, come on. You know, that was a withdrawal. And so I get back, and I went to the third meeting, and a gentleman came and talked to me, and I thought, no, not going there. And I said, you know what? I don't need AA. I don't need it, because you know what? I got enough books, and I got enough tapes, and I got enough of everything. I'm going to be just fine. Now, Dave is continuing in Al-Anon, and he's doing his thing. He's all spiritual, Mr. Al-Anon, and then there's me, you know, and I'm, you know, he's just doing his thing there. And, you know, I decided I don't need it, and I'm listening to the tapes 1 month, and then they're starting to be put away, and then they're starting to put away, and then suddenly a thought. February 28th, I know exactly the day, 28th, 1992, I picked up that drink. I'm here to tell you, to have a head full of AA and a belly full of booze is like having a fence post rammed right up your butt, and you are in such pain. But I continue to drink, and my husband sits and watches me, and you know what he does? Nothing. Nothing. He sits and watches me drink. And the drinking got worse. And the drinking became, you know, they told me that it grows even though you have stopped. This disease grows. Completely forgetting about the physical aspect of the disease. 1994, December 11th, 1994, I was at a party at the Marine Corps ball. Was that what? We were at a ball, and I get totally wasted. David's left because he's probably disgusted with me. Again, I'll let him tell you. And I ended up falling in a fountain that was in front of the Manhattan, and that's the name of the complex we lived in. And not only did I live in a fountain by myself in this beautiful dress, but there was also a man in that fountain too. And next thing I know is the Hong Kong police or the security guards are taking me up to the room and up to the house. And when I opened the door, there stands my husband and my kids. And it's a face that hasn't been imprinted onto my mind. Like, I did it again. I did it again. And I walked up into that bathroom, and Dave just, I can still see his face and his shoulders slumped. And I just, you know, pick up my wet dress, and I go upstairs, and I started thinking, oh, No, I don't need AA. No, I'm not going back to AA. I'm not going to AA. And what I did is, because I'm a religious education director for the Catholic Church, I'm going to teach those little kids the rosary. And I'm going to get into that church. And I'm going to just get sober. And that's exactly what I did. And for 1 year, 11 months, I walked around with actual blood in here from holding in my nails going, I'm going to stay sober. And I was so, it's that time between that drink to the next drink is where I can't live. I can't live between that. I'm not living because when I drink, I go to oblivion. And when I'm not drinking, all I'm doing is thinking about drinking. And then I come to that drink again, and then I have that ease and comfort that they talk about. I can't live in between. I don't know how to do that. But I thought I could. And so in December of 1995, we moved to Colorado because we adopted a little girl. This poor little girl, she's 5 years old. She's got problems. Mom's got problems. I'm drinking. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to sober up, and she's seeing, my daughter has never seen me ingest alcohol, but she has definitely seen my anger and rage. And the behavior that one has with untreated alcoholism, where you just can't live life on life's terms, and you are mad at everybody for whatever reason, look at me a certain way, you're disagreeable, I just could not get along with anybody. Everybody was doing everything wrong. So in December, we flew back to Colorado, and we're on a United flight, and I said, God, if you can just get me home, I promise you I'll walk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on December 15th in 1995, I walked into an AA meeting in Elizabeth, Colorado. And when I walked into that room, I wasn't going to tell you people. The arrogance was unbelievable. I was not going to tell you what happened. I was going to tell you because I got caught up on the years. Those years, I've got all these years, but my life was a mess. But I had all these years, and then I went out and drank, and I'm not going to tell you what happened. Well, I go to this meeting, and it was a great meeting, and I don't remember the meeting, and they're reading out of the 12 and 12, and next thing I know is it's my turn, and I'm reading, and I start crying, this uncontrollable crying. And this Native American who's sitting right next to me, just what I heard him say is he pat me on the back, and I heard him say, welcome back. And I went, how did you know? I don't think he knew anything. Now that I look backwards, I think I scared the hell out of him. But, I just said, how did you know? And with that, this group that I walked into, there was a woman who was sitting in the corner, and all I know is she had red on. She walked up to me, and she goes, I'll be your sponsor. And that woman took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that opened my eyes, a way that, because I was done. I was toast. I was going to cry uncle at that point because I didn't want to live the way I wanted to live. Being without a drink and not having a sufficient substitute, oh my gosh, I'm a nutcase. So I went through this book with this woman, and this woman was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And as she was reading me through the book, she takes me to step one. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, the unmanageability is not about the circumstances out here in my life. It's not about, that I lost a car, that my husband, I walked out on my kids. Almost a DUI. I got out of those DUIs by I was just very sweet and carried NyQuil with me. I've got bad cough, and I got out of that. In the circumstances out here, I thought that was unmanageability. The unmanageability is when I think I can pick up a drink and it's going to be different this time. It doesn't say in step one for Marie to admit she's an alcoholic. It says to admit that she's powerless, because it's easy to admit you're an alcoholic. But to admit I'm powerless? Are you flipping kidding me? No, I'm powerless over alcohol. Now that I'm powerless, now what do you do? You know, and it says, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, you know, to restore us to our sanity. You know, it says could restore. He didn't say he wouldn't, second step. You know? And so what I did is she says, now, Marie, just, do you believe in a God? And of course I did. I did. I had no problem with God. I thought it was his mother once in a while, but, you know, I got the head of thing with Mary once in a while. I would talk to her, but, you know, and so, you know, I was insane. Yeah, you know, sanity. And so I had to flip that around and say, yes, I'm powerless, but I'm powerful. I have the power that comes through that, from a power. The third step, making a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, it's one of the greatest decisions I've ever made. The second step was the decision about the power, and the third is for the power. And I made a decision that I'm going to turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to this power. I didn't argue with it. I cried uncle, and I was ready to change and do whatever you told me to do. But I still am very arrogant, and I still think I know it all. And I suffer from that. My parents said, you know, if you didn't know an answer, you better make one up, because you were supposed to know no matter what. So in that third step, I made that decision, which next launched me into that fourth step, which is just fact-finding, fact-facing mission. That's all it is, what was working, you know. Fourth step is really nothing, but it's everything. It's nothing, but it's everything. Where's these resentments, these deep resentments? You know, I lived on these belief systems, these principles, you know. If you don't know the answer, make it up. Don't be stupid. Prove yourself. All these principles, you know, these all these things. I can't think of them from the podium, but all these things that I believed in. I believed in, and they're not true. You know, in the fifth step, you find this woman, and I found this woman, and I admitted everything to her with no holds bar. No holds bar. I would love to sit here and tell you that I walked away with this light, airy feeling. No. Because you know what? I'm a woman who will beat herself up because I'm a victim. I'm a victim to the T. I'm a victim to the T. I'm a visual learner. As I'm one of those learners that you have to show me how things are. And so my sponsor took me out to lunch. She takes me out to lunch, and she has this nice little package. It's just this beautiful little package, and we're at the lunch, and she shoves it across, and she goes, this is for you, and I go, oh, for me? I'm thinking, oh, thank you. What's on my birthday or anything? She goes, oh, no, it's just for you. So I opened it up, and there's a brooch in there, and there's this wonderful brooch with the letter V. Well, my name's M. And I looked at it, and I go, M, V? But my name's Marie. She goes, oh, no, sweetheart. You're a victim. Wear it well. And I love that woman for her. I was really angry, but I was a victim. It was always everyone else's fault while I was here. Don't you know? You would have drank too if you had the family that I was raised in. You would have drank too if you had the husband I had. You would have drank too if you had lived in Hong Kong. You would have drank. That's why I picked up that drink in 92, because it was because of you and the moon and the stars and everything around. That's why I drank. Not realizing that I drink for one reason. I'm an alcoholic, and when I drink and I ingest alcohol and it's in my body, all bets are off, baby. All bets are off. Now the drink's out. Now you got this angry woman. Ooh. And that's what AA is about. It teaches me to find this power and to live in a way of in life that is just beyond none. So we go. She takes me to the sixth step. You know? And in the sixth step, it says, we are entitled to have God remove all these defects of character. I love when I used to say, I'm working on my character defects, and my sponsor would just laugh. She goes, when did your name get in the big book? And I went, what? She goes, no, it says God, Marie, not you, God. And then we get to the seventh step. And the sixth and the seventh step to me remind me, the Pacific Fleet used to come into Hong Kong, and it used to come in through, and I would watch these mighty ships come through. They're huge aircraft carriers, huge. I'm sure some of you have been on them, in worked them, or but I went on them, and you know, behind them they've got these rudders, and I'm really bad with names, these rudders that can turn that mighty ship around. That's 6 and 7. It turns me around to become a woman in recovery, integrity, and stands with her shoulders high. She's done some shameful things. She comes from a shameful place. And 6 and 7 is able to take that and turn that around so that I'm able to go into the 8th and to the 9th step and make the amends that I need to make. The greatest amends I've made was to my husband. You know, we'll be married 42 years in February. You're going to think we're nuts, but I'll tell you the truth. You know, a therapist told me once, listen, if you don't figure out what's wrong with you, you're going to marry someone like him. And I went, oh, God. Let me see what I can do with him. So it's been a great ride. So, you know, so in the 8th and the 9th step, I made these amends. And in these amends, you know, I had children, my kids, walking out on my 2 kids. And my one son who wasn't talking to me. My one son who didn't want anything to do with me. And you would tell me, just write him letters, birthday cards, whatever it took. And you know what? He now talks to me. And he allows me to hold his kids. You know? A husband who trusts me when I walk at the door, when I say I'm going to be home in 15 minutes, I'm home in 15 minutes. A mother and a father that worried about me that I had no idea worried about me. I had no idea that they even worried about me. And before their death, they said to me, Marie, whatever you're doing, just keep on doing it. Now, they knew I was an AA, but they really thought that all of this was due to because I gave a baby up for adoption. They really thought that that was it, you know. They didn't. But my mom and dad drink. I can't call them an alcoholic. Yeah, they walk like a duck, they quack like a duck, but I'm not real sure they're a duck. But they had died. My mother died in 2000, and I had a relationship with her. And my father, I took care of him till he died. The last 6 months of his life, you gave me the great privilege of being able to be there for him, for this man who screamed and yelled. And then I had a sister in sobriety who, she found Jesus. She didn't have wanted anything to do with AA, but it was through her. She didn't stay Catholic. She went to another religion, and that was a shame on the house. But she went to another religion that brought her great peace. And through that, she died sober, but not through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to take care of her in her dying days. For the last 6 months of her life, I was with her at every moment. She died in my arms. And that's a gift you gave me. That's a gift you gave me, because I couldn't have done that for her. You taught me to show up. You taught me to be there. I didn't have to get angry when she died. I didn't have to go through all those stuff. She did. I didn't have to do that. You know, in that 10 and 11 step, I was sharing last night at a meeting. If you're here, at 17 years, I hit this slam. And what had happened was, I was going along AA, I was going along in AA, and I was going to my home group, and I was really happy, and I was, you know, on the surface, everything was good. But what happened was, and how important the 10th step is for me, is we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Well, that promptly we were wrong, admitted it, was I did that. But I forgot the other instructions of step 10, you know. We ask God to remove it. We talk to someone immediately. That's the one I forgot. And I would go to the amends and then resolutely turn our thoughts to helping someone else. Forgot that one too. And so, my prayers at 17 years were very much what they looked like when I was 10 years sober, 5 years sober, 4 years sober. I was, you know, I was very rote in what I did. because that's what you told me to do. And that's what I did. And I taught my sponsees that. And if I have sponsor, I always have fresh meat in front of me. I love those newcomers. Absolutely love them in front of me because they keep me where I am today. They keep me right here. And so I started doing, and I going down Queens Road East, I honestly had this moment of, what the heck, is this all my life is going to be? Is this? Scared me to death. Called my sponsor. We sat down, and she said, where are you in 10 and 11? And what I've come to believe is that 10 and 11 is the infinity loop of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that step one takes me to live in 10 and 11 and 12. It takes me to live there. So when I do that every night, every day, it's like this bird that watches me and what I'm doing. How am I behaving? Am I saying the right things? Am I acting like an adult? Am I being kind? Am I being miserable and able to look at that? You know, I said this earlier. I said, I don't know about you, but I wake up every morning with these two vultures. Every morning, right there, right here. Oh, Marie, what are you doing? You're too fat. Look at you in the mirror. Oh, my God, what are you doing with all those sponsors? They're not going to listen to you anyway. You think you're a big shot. And it's like vultures, you know. And if you know anything about vultures, they love to eat dead things and pick at the dead bones. You know, they're the garbage can of God made them the cleanup crew, you know. And they're just out there getting my dead bones until I get to my knees and go to the living water that gives me life to my bones. Those thoughts are going to continually do that. And sometimes those vultures will meet me, they'll meet me, Jeff and Michael meet me at least 3-4 times a day if I'm not set right and have to get on my knees, you know. And in that 11th step, it brought me to a place of quiet and solitude. I love the 11th step. I love living in that. And with that, Dave, and you know, Dave is a very prayerful man. And in that prayer, he came to me one day and he said, hey, Marie, he goes, why don't we go look for that son that we gave up? And I said, I don't want to open those bag of worms. Because back in the 80s, I tried, couldn't do it because it was closed adoption. Tried again 7 years later, couldn't do it then because the adoption agency name had changed. And then tried again one more time. And there was a fire. And we couldn't, it was a fire, and so that was done. I thought, okay, it's done. I mean, it's just done. And Dave just said, Marie, why don't we just go try? And so I went through all this rigmarole, and I tried, and I finally figured out that with the fire, it was the records, they were microfiche, the records that had the PEEF, the LMNOP from 1971 to 1973, no, 75, something like that, they didn't burn, and that's mine, P, 1974, you know? So they found him, and then adoption agency changed. Fast forward, because of the life that I live and what you have given me, God presented this boy back into my life. He's 33 years old, and I met him. Dave and I went down to Florida to meet him when he was 33 years old, married, and had two children at that time. We have a relationship today that I didn't think would ever, ever happen. He's going to celebrate Thanksgiving dinner with us this year. They call me Grandma. Call him Grandpa. You know, they have a brother and a sister. He has a blood brother and sister, Lisa and Paul, who we have. You know, this would have never happened. I believe it would have never happened if it wasn't for the prayerful life that I lead that you have given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. If you would have known me, the Daisy Duke short, spiky hair that came in here, I'm not the woman. I'm nowhere near the woman I was when I came here. Yeah, I can still be nutty as a fruitcake, but I'm not mean. I try not to be mean today. I try to be respectful of where I am and who I'm with, you know, because there's a piece of me that you've given to me, and I carry you in my heart. I really do. I've been all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've a great honor living in Hong Kong, great honor of being part of the Asia-Oceania Service Committee meeting, where we sat at the table in India, where they were doing the translations in all the languages over there, you know? And I was able to go to the yurts of Mongolia, that I was able to bring the steps to India, to the women in India, because culturally men and women can't sit together. And in Qatar, and in the Middle Eastern region, I was able to sit with the people and what they were doing with AA over there, to the native people there. This is an amazing, amazing way to live. And the lives I've seen changed, you know? Doesn't matter if the Serenity Prayer or the steps are in Chinese, English, Thai, Filipino. When you sit in that room, you know it. There's a language of the heart that you can't get anywhere else. You can't. And David was the same with Al-Anon. I'll let him tell his story. You know, and so the 12 step brings me to a place where I sponsor. But you know, the greatest gift that the 12 step has given me is in my family. I practice all these principles in all my affairs. It's with my family. You've healed my family. You've given me back the family that alcohol took away. You know, and I had plans when I came in here thinking what my life was going to look like. I thought if I had written how I thought my life would look like, I wouldn't be here today. Because I really would have screwed it up. I really would have. This way of life was tough in the beginning. I really did think I died and went to hell. But you have shown me love. You've shown it to me. You didn't tell me about it. You showed me it. By picking up the phone at 2:00 in the morning when this alcoholic really thought she wanted a drink. And you taught me to answer the phone when there's another woman at the other end of the phone. You've taught me to sponsor. You've taught me to sponsor. You've taught me to greet at the door. You've taught me to say hello to the newcomer. And most importantly, to say somebody new to the old timer who might be sitting in the back of the room who's hurting and is too doggone arrogant to say anything. I've been there. They don't know where to go because I didn't know where to go because I have all these years and I think I got it all and I'm dying. If it wasn't for the sponsor and the gift of being sponsored, I don't know where I would be. Meetings are wonderful, but my sponsor helped me. That's God with skin on. And I like to end it with something. You know, as I travel this road, my life as I look backwards, faith is looking backwards. And I almost feel like this cool wind always blowing me forward. I breathe and I know I'm breathing and the breath is God. And I absolutely believe that today. Sponsoring this woman right now who you all know and who you all love. And God prepared me for this woman. I would have never known that, but she has prepared me for this woman in my life today. Can't tell you why, I can't tell you what for, but sponsees prepare you for whatever that is in front of you. Whatever it is, no matter if they're 16, 15 years old, or 105 years old. We've got a great gift here, a great gift. I hope we're not hiding it under a bushel basket. And then we bring it out. And the way I look at it in this recovery process is, like I said, I have to look backwards and see where I'm at. You know, and so I'm going to go backwards with the principles, which help me see where I'm at. And then I'll see the weak link in the chain of the steps that I need to be on. Number 20, you know, you start with step 12, that's in service. Am I in service today? 11, am I in attunement? Am I in one with my God today? And if I'm in attunement, that's in step 10, that must mean I'm in vigilance. I'm doing step 10. And if I'm in attunement, that means I'm in amendment. All my amends have been made for that day. And if I'm in amendment, then I've been reflecting. I'm in reflection. Step 8. And if I'm in step 8, then I go to step 7. Am I in humility? Am I standing before my God, being right size and who he wants me to be? And if I'm in humility, that means in step 6, I must have some willingness. And do I have some willingness today to do what it takes to be who God wants me to be? And if I'm in willingness, that means I'm in truth in step 5. I'm living in truth. And if I'm living in truth, step 5, that means I must have a level of honesty in step 4. Not honesty with you, because that's easy. Honesty with me. And if I've got the honesty, it's because I've made a commitment, and that's in step 3. And if I made this commitment, then I must be in some kind of hope. And I got all of this because I surrendered. And for that, I'm entirely grateful for all of you, for giving the life I have, because it's only by divine providence that I'm standing here today. Thank you.